All right. Thank you to the Perimeter Institute for the opportunity to visit here. I have never been, I haven't visited Perimeter before, and it's good to see some of the former friends and acquaintances. You know, it's a good opportunity to do that here. And what I want to give you today, those in the room and those on Zoom, a flavor of what we work on, basically, at IUPUI. And it's a talk which can be sort of, you know, compressed down to really small level, or it can be expanded out to a lecture's course. So this is more of a 30,000 foot overview. And I'm happy to talk to people if you have questions or want to. I'm very interested in sort of exploring these ideas across different disciplines and domains. And so as I'll show you, they do show up across different disciplines and domains of physics. And so I want to sort of give you an overview, and then we'll go from there. So I am at IUPUI, one of the few palindromic name universities up here. And what we do is a theory group which has students which are across the board, starting from high school students all the way to postdocs. And we work on models which are sort of our, I guess our models are platform agnostic in terms of what kind of experimental realization we have in mind to begin with. And then we work very closely with experimentalists to sort of then work on details of each of these models to see interesting things that happen in this broad area of what is called PT symmetry, or paradigm symmetry, or non-Hermitian physics, and things of that type, basically. Okay. The work I will talk about today, particularly, has been done in collaboration with these four experimental groups, basically. I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to work with a lot of really great experimentalists across different platforms. And because we study models which are platform agnostic, we are able to sort of, you know, work with different people and to realize different phenomena that come across. So in particular, Kater Murch is at Washington University, and the platform he has is a single superconducting transmon, if you wish, or a qubit, or a few-level system, which is a superconducting circuit. Lei Luo used to be at IUPUI. He has a lithium-6 ultra-cold atom in a magneto-optic trap as the platform. Roberto Leon is in Mexico City at UNAM, and he works on the experimental platform he has is synthetic circuits. So this is electrical classical models, electrical systems, basically just electrical slash electronic circuits. And then most recently, we have started working with University of Oregon, where David Alcock and David Weinland's group has basically a trapped ion, a single trapped ion, again, which can be used to make a qubit, basically. Okay? So I will tell you about sort of, you know, examples of the interesting stuff that we do and how it is realized across these different platforms, basically. And the point of sort of, you know, showing this is that you find similar physics at multiple scales. Okay? So to give you an example specifically, these two platforms have dynamics that occur on microsecond scales, basically, okay, right? This platform has dynamics that happens in the kilohertz range. This platform has dynamics that happens in, you know, maybe tens of hertz range, basically. And you can find similar models describing physics that's occurring on all these different time scales and wider in this area of PT symmetry. And please feel free to interrupt me. I guess if there are interruptions on Zoom, you will know about them, right, basically? Okay, yeah. Because we can sort of wrap up the talk or expand it out. All right, so let me start out by setting the stage, because we are at sort of, you know, perimeter and generally theoretical quantum descriptions, by telling about two types of quantum dynamics which we normally deal with, basically, which are most commonplace in descriptions of quantum systems. On the left-hand side is what we call unitary dynamics. So Schrodinger equation describing the evolution of your state vector. The Hamiltonian in there, that H naught, it's Hermitian, it could be time dependent. And if you are considering some effective models, it could even be nonlinear. So I'm thinking about sort of nonlinear Schrodinger equation, for example, which is not really describing quantum systems, but it's describing some effective models, you know, light propagating in some medium with nonlinearities, or, you know, fluid waves and things of that type. But in general, that's one model that we're familiar with, which is unitary dynamics. This is a dynamics which is most common and sort of idealized version, basically, that you have. So on the left-hand side, from quantum computing point of view, left-hand side is the ideal world, you know. Okay. Hermitian dynamics, you have unitary gates, perfect fidelities, blah, blah, blah. This kind of, all the features that you want. And the characteristics of those are that you have a Hermitian Hamiltonian. Therefore, you have, for a density matrix, constant purity and entropy. Those things are time invariants, basically, you know. Of course, this dynamics can be implemented in a variety of ways across different platforms of qubits, particularly. You can have a continuous time quantum walk, which is what happens in the case of, you know, for example, superconducting qubits or trapped ions or ultracold atoms. These are the examples of qubits in which case the dynamics are implemented by some Hamiltonian, and so that's a continuous time quantum walk. In the case of photons, this would be a discrete time quantum walk, basically, where you have photons which are propagating in some kind of an integrated device, and essentially you have beam splitters or phase shifters, which are the sort of, you know, gates that are implemented, as opposed to a Hamiltonian that is implemented and time evolved. Okay, and so the left hand side is stuff that we are familiar with, which is unitary dynamics. Okay. That's the ideal world for quantum computation. The right hand side is the reality for small quantum systems, which is what is called dissipative dynamics. And this is a dynamics which talks about what happens if I have a small quantum system coupled to a large environment. And then, although the total Hamiltonian, the total dynamics would be unitary, if I only look at what is the dynamics of the reduced density matrix for the system, then that, in under, you know, very good mild sort of assumptions, is described by this equation, which is called Lindblad equation, basically. No. Yeah. So the time derivative of rho is some commutator piece, which is something that you would get if there was no coupling to the environment, basically. That's just Heisenberg equation of motion kind of thing. And then the other piece that's down there is what describes the effect of the coupling to the environment in terms of dissipators. So the L operators are called dissipators, basically, and I have written it in this particular form to sort of emphasize that there is an anti-commutator term here, and then there is another term here, which is what I will call quantum jump term, basically. Okay. The gammas here are described or governed by whatever is the density of states in the environment, for example. Okay. And this is also very well known. I mean, I'm not telling you anything new. This one leads to, starting with a pure state, you will generate entropy, or you will generate a mixed state density matrix, typically, if I am having dynamics that's undergone according to that. So the right-hand side is the reality for quantum systems, basically, small quantum systems. And the idea is that it is decoherence, but it is trace-preserving. That's why you have this particular combination of things, is because this combination of parameters preserves the trace of the density matrix, basically. It gives rise to non-reversible behavior. That's why you have this whole Lindblad semi-group approach, basically, to quantum maps, right? And so in this case, generally speaking, or at least under normal, dissipator choices, if you haven't done some really sophisticated bath engineering, then what you are going to get is an increasing entropy for a pure state over time. Yeah? So left-hand side, constant entropy, and, you know, a unitary evolution. Right-hand side is what is called CPTP maps, basically completely positive trace preserving maps, in which case you will get increasing entropy depending on what kind of drives and things like that you have. But those are the generic features, basically. Okay. Left-hand side is the good one. The right-hand side is the one which is keeping you from making really good quantum computers, basically. Right. And what I'm going to tell you today is a third class of quantum dynamics, which shares the features with those two, but gives rise to results which are completely different from these two, basically. And so that class of dynamics is what happens if you could ignore this term, basically. This term is called quantum jump term. And I will tell you how what I mean by ignore this term, and you know, how do you do it in experiment, and what stuff you get. But the basic idea is that if you are able to ignore these quantum jump terms, then the equation of motion for a dissipative system looks like this. Yes. Where now you get some effective Hamiltonian, which is non-Hermitian. It contains pieces which are associated with the dissipator, basically. Okay. And this non-Hermitian Hamiltonian has very different properties than any Hermitian Hamiltonian or with Lindblad dynamics, basically. So you are getting coherent but non-unitary evolution. And this has consequences. So for example, let me tell you one consequence right now before we get into the details. One consequence is that this evolution maintains pure states. So if I have a pure state, it will remain pure. But if I have a mixed state, its entropy changes with time. This is not a behavior that you find either here or there. Here, pure states remain pure, but you know, the mixed states, the entropy remains same. Here, nothing remains pure, entropy changes. This is a class where you can get both. Pure states remain pure, mixed states start to show oscillations in the entropy, okay? And things of that type.
What does coherent mean exactly?
So coherent mean that it's not a semigroup, basically. It's reversible, okay, in this language. The evolution that you are going to get is not unitary, but it's also reversible. Yeah.
Sorry, question. So if you ignore that, the fluctuation term or jump term, the last term in the equation, I think then it's not trace preserving, right?
Okay, very good. That's why this red stuff, which is non-trivial stuff that I say, is that when I say post-selection, what it really means is not just ignoring that term. If I ignore that term, then indeed I will not get unitary evolution. So it's ignoring that term plus instantaneous renormalization is what corresponds mathematically to the fact that experimentally you are only post-selecting certain trajectories. So the mathematical description is not really just this. It's this plus some extra piece, which is a nonlinear term in rho, which compensates for the trace that is changing. Okay, good. I'm glad you brought it up, because then I don't need to talk about what is that non-trivial stuff that I need to mention. Okay, so here is the idea. Essentially, you get if I have this kind of a process where I take a dissipative system, but instead of looking at all of its quantum trajectories, I only look at quantum trajectories or post-selectron quantum trajectories which don't undergo quantum jump, then I get a dynamics which is very different. It's a dynamics according to this non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. And so now what I'm going to tell you about is sort of give you an overview of, okay, what are the properties of non-Hermitian Hamiltonians? How do you make them? And what are the kind of key features, basically? And it will turn out PT symmetry is one of the special cases of those kind of models. Okay, and so that's sort of the idea. So here is the outline of my talk. I wanted to go over this piece because I wanted to establish where it sits in the broad picture of quantum information and, in general, sort of quantum mechanics or quantum dynamics. So I'll start with a brief history of PT symmetry and particularly focus on how you can think about PT systems as systems which are time-reversed, coupling time-reversed systems with each other, basically, okay? With the definition of EPs, and then I'll give you sort of key properties of these models by considering a static model and demonstrating it with some superconducting qubit platform, and the time periodic model, and that one demonstrating it with ultra-cold atoms. If I have time, I'll go over some classical models that we do, and then end with possibilities and open questions, basically. So here is the history of PT symmetry, which sort of started with Karl Bender, although there were some signs of it in the early 90s with Jindalstein and others. And the idea was that let's consider a non-Hermitian potential. The story really started with a paper by Karl Bender and co-workers, which is from 98. And what they considered were simple non-relativistic Schrodinger equation with a potential of this form. So when epsilon is zero, then this is your simple harmonic oscillator that you are very familiar with. And what is shown here are the energies of this particular problem as a function of epsilon. So when epsilon is zero, you get 1, 3, 5, 7. Those are your regular simple harmonic oscillator energies. When epsilon is one, this is a potential which is I times x cubed. There's no business thinking about such a potential typically, because it does not make any sense, basically. What is meant by a purely imaginary potential? But anyway, Karl and co-workers went ahead and did calculations of how do the eigenspectrum of these Hamiltonians looks like. And that is how it looks like. So in particular, for epsilon equals 1, what you see, once again, are purely real spectra, which was found for all values of epsilon, which is positive. Okay. And so when epsilon is negative, on the other hand, what you find is that there are a few real eigenvalues. And beyond that, they become complex conjugates. So there are a few ones which you find as real. About that, the rest of it is complex eigenvalues, which are not shown in this picture. Okay, basically. All right, fine. Then the question was, okay, why is this happening? What's the meaning of it? Is this physics? Is this mathematics? And the first decade or so was spent on those kind of considerations. If you have real spectra, you can do two things. The cost you pay, because it's not a Hermitian Hamiltonian, is that although the spectrum is real, the eigenvectors are not orthogonal to each other. Because remember, if I have real spectrum and orthogonal eigenvectors, then you have a Hermitian Hamiltonian, basically, and a unitary evolution. If the eigenvectors are not orthogonal, then you can do two things. One is, live with it and the non-unitarity and try to understand what it means. Or the first approach was, if I have these real eigenvalues and the eigenvectors are not orthogonal, maybe we redefine the inner product so that the operator becomes self-adjoint but under some new inner product. Yeah. And that was the process, that sort of mathematical physics-y stuff that went on for quite a while. And in all large family of sort of examples where this was discovered, what was found was this happens when these potentials are a function of I times x. And that's where the PT part comes in. They found this feature every time the potential was non-Hermitian, but was invariant under combined operations of parity, which takes x to minus x, and time reversal, which takes I to minus I. That's why you keep seeing sort of, functions of I times x, basically. Okay? So fine, it was from 98 to almost until 2010 or something, this was a mathematical physics sort of studies to try and understand what is meant by non-Hermitian Hamiltonian, which have real spectra. Does that mean we can do something new? Is there a complex extension of quantum theory, and so on and so forth? And because these calculations are actually quite challenging to do for continuum differential equations on an infinite line, it turns out, although, that most of the key features there are shared by this simple 2x2 model. Now, something that high school students can solve. So these are 2x2 Hamiltonian. These are your usual Pauli matrices, basically. So it's like a case with one real field and one purely imaginary field. I'll show you how this one actually comes about. This one does come about in actual physical system. Okay. So this is the Hamiltonian that you have, and its eigenvalues are, of course, given by that. That's something we are all familiar with. And you can see that these eigenvalues would be real if gamma is smaller than j, and they will be purely complex conjugate pairs when gamma is greater than j. Okay, right. And at the transition that is happening between these two points happens at when gamma is equal to j, or the non-Hermitian energy scale matches the Hermitian energy scale. This is a feature you will see all the time in most of the problems, is that this PT transition occurs when the anti-Hermitian energy scale matches the Hermitian energy scale. That's the exceptional point, basically. All right, so I would like you to keep this example in mind, because most of the stuff we'll do will be, decorating these examples with non-trivialities that are required if you want to describe something real, basically. But at the heart of it, this is all there is, basically. Okay. All right, so I told you, this was theory. This was for almost 10 years, from 1998 to 2008, 2009 or so. But there was no clear understanding of, is it physics or is it something else? Can we ever see this, a potential like I times X, for example? Yeah. And that crucial insight was provided by Crystal Ulides, who is a theorist working in optics primarily. He used to be at in Florida. And what he realized was the following. He realized that Schrodinger equation actually is isomorphic to basically Parexel approximation to Maxwell's equation. And this is another way of saying that if I have light which is propagating in an array of waveguides, then if I try to obtain the equation for the envelope of this electric field of the light that is propagating, then that equation looks actually identical to Schrodinger equation, basically. Okay? No. And in that case, the role for the potential is played by the index of refraction. Okay. And this index of refraction we know can be complex. We live with it. People try to eliminate it because the imaginary part of the index of refraction is nothing but losses, absorption. That's how you model frequency-dependent index of refraction, which has a negative imaginary part, basically. Okay. And so this PT symmetry, when it came to light propagating in such a channel, meant that you needed to have a complex index of refraction which satisfies this equation. Okay. So if I have some waveguide structure, and on this side I have some loss, then on its mirror symmetric side, I need to have equal amount of gain. If I have a potential which is I times X, then for negative X, it's an absorbing medium. And for positive X, it's an amplifying medium, basically. Okay. And I think once this insight came about, then it really opened up floodgates of experiments. So this was one of the first papers. I think it's now, well, I guess it's from 2010, so you know, more than a decade old, where they did exactly this. They had two waveguides in lithium niobate, glass, basically. One of the waveguides had some iron impurities implanted so that if light, you put in light in it, then the intensity of light decayed as a function of time or as a function of the direction, distance along that direction. Okay. It just led to exponential decay, creating some effective negative potential, basically. No, it's a lossy mode. And then they created another waveguide in which they had patterned with some gain medium on top of the waveguide, which was being pumped, so that if light, you put in light in it, then it amplified as it went along. Okay? And now these two, if you put them very far away, then they're not talking to each other and they're kind of boring. You have one amplifying mode and you have one decaying mode. What's interesting is when you bring them close together, then because the light can go back and forth because of the evanescent coupling between the two waveguides, you suddenly get stable modes. You get propagating modes instead of only amplifying. You get oscillatory periodic modes instead of just amplifying or just decaying modes, basically. And that transition is essentially PT transition. So PT, or parity time symmetry, meaning effective balanced gain and loss, is something that sort of became clear in classical systems. And once you have this idea, because it's such a generic idea, you can really look for it everywhere. So people started to do stuff with, you know, this one is from Kotos's group in Wesleyan University, which is, well, I mean, dissipation is commonplace, right? So let's take an LC circuit, or RLC circuit more specifically, okay? We teach it at our undergrads, you know, RLC circuit, that's physics 101. You have this decay of the current in the circuit as a function of time, that's fine. And now what I need to do is to couple it to a gain circuit. So in other words, a circuit which has negative resistance, or what is meant by that is really that it's a circuit which has some operational amplifier such that the amplitude of the current in that circuit is increasing as a function of time. It looks like an RLC circuit just, you know, run backward in time, basically. Okay? And now you couple them inductively, these two, and you have a gain-loss system. You have a PT system. And in this case, the time evolution is not unitary. Energy is not conserved, but that's okay because it's an open system. There are parts of it where it's leaking energy, and there are parts of it where it is gaining energy from the environment. So unitary behavior is not expected, basically. Yeah. You can do it with electrical circuits. You can do it with, you know, mechanical system. Just take two pendulum. There's one pendulum which is decaying out because of you introduce some kind of friction, and there's another pendulum which is being kicked. So that, you know, its energy or amplitude is increasing with time. If you leave them be, they are boring. But if you connect them with sufficiently good transfer of energy from one to the other, then they will get stabilized. Yeah. And so with this idea, a lot of work started to do in this PT in the classical domain, basically. So we have done a bunch of things too, like, you know, synthetic circuits, electrical circuits, or lasers. Lasers is another commonplace thing where you have gain and loss ideas very easily manifested. So you could think about one laser which is below threshold when standalone, coupling with another laser which is above threshold when standalone. And when you feed it back and forth, then you get a system which looks like PT. It's more involved than that because there's some time delay, and, you know, delayed differential equations are more complicated than normal linear differential equations, but the idea is the same, basically. And so this is really the heart of what is sort of, you know, PT systems or parity time symmetric systems, which is the following. I think I've been sort of talking about it, but here's my example of it, which is, you know, what you're doing is you're coupling two time reverse systems. So on the left-hand side, it's just a pendulum, which is, you know, it's a cat pendulum, fine, but it doesn't matter. The point is that it does not matter. That's the whole sort of, that's why I have these two examples, which are completely different, taken together. The left-hand side is the frictional or a lossy system. Whether it's a cat pendulum or something else doesn't matter. But what happens is, as a function of time, things decay out, basically. So this is a part where time reversal symmetry is explicitly broken. You can tell forward in time from backward in time. The same thing on the right-hand side. On the right-hand side is an example of a gainy system. This one is called ground resonance, apparently. If you have a helicopter, one of these helicopters which have, you know, two rotors on the top, and if they are sitting on the ground, because ground transfers actually provides a mixing between these two parametric resonance, unless things are matched correctly, this is what happens, actually. If this helicopter were to take off, it will stop, basically. No, it will be stable. But if it's on the ground, then this is a gain medium, basically. Okay? And the gain medium means that the amplitude is increasing as a function of time. And once again, this one has, it's a gainy system, and this one has, once again, time reversal symmetry broken, basically. And the idea is you couple these two systems, a lossy system and its time reverse version, you couple them together. And if the coupling is finite but efficient, then you restore time reversal symmetry. In other words, you get periodic behavior. Periodic, not just oscillatory, with constant amplitude, basically. And that's the key part, right? So you are not eliminating friction. You're not compensating for it locally. And when I said time reversal, you know, you sort of couple it with time reverse system, I also don't mean exact time reversal, which you cannot do. So, you know, if I have an RLC circuit which has a loss, then the negative RLC circuit is not sort of, you know, cooling the air around the resistor and somehow increasing the current in the circuit. No, it's just effective time reversal that you need. And if you do that, then you get stabilized behavior. And this is the bottom sort of the main feature of PT is take a system which has time reversal symmetry broken, couple it with its time reverse version, and see what happens when the coupling is efficient, basically. And because of this idea being so generic, you can literally run with it across the board. So, you know, take whatever is your area of research, whatever is your field, interesting problems or whatever, okay, and making them PT, basically. And that's what my group has been doing for the last probably decade or so. Yeah. You just sort of try to work on different variety of problems depending on your area of interest. And then because this phenomenon is also commonplace, we have been fortunate enough to work with a whole lot of experimentalists across a variety of platforms. Because you can find these platforms in quantum domains like, you know, superconducting qubit or trapped ions, or, you know, I guess atoms or ions. You can do it in photonics, which is obvious choice for gain and loss, basically. You can do it with lasers. You can even do it in sort of classical models, such as shallow fluids, which is described by, you know, nonlinear Schrodinger equation, for example, okay, right? Or viscous fluids and a variety of such models. So this is, yeah.
What was the original context for that, you know, in Bender's paper?
What was the original context for Bender's paper?
For this proposal in Bender's paper. Was it just mathematical problem or
Right. Okay. So the history of Bender's paper actually comes from people knowing that if I have a phi cube theory with a prefactor which is imaginary, then whether that is stable or not. And so that came to, instead of field theory, then Ix cube potential, which people, numerical calculations showed was stable in the sense of having a bounded below spectrum, you know, with purely real eigenvalues. Yeah. So it was known for Ix cubed even earlier in mid 90s, Zinzerstein and other people knew about it. But then the Bender's main work was then to sort of figure out, oh, this underlying symmetry seems to be relevant to this, basically. All right, so now in the remaining time that I have, what I'm going to do is, now that I've given you sort of an overview of what is PT symmetry, I'm going to tell you about key features of or properties of the models that come about and why they are so general, and you know, give you examples of what all you can do with it, okay, basically. So because differential equations are hard and matrices are simple, I'm going to start with really, really simple models, which is 2x2 matrices. Okay. There's a good reason for it, actually. Even if you have many-level system, what happens is that the phenomenon of PT breaking, or phenomenon of this complex eigenvalue emergence, occurs when two or more levels come together, become degenerate, and become complex. Okay. So effectively, if you have an anti-Hermitian potential, with a Hermitian potential, perturbation theory sort of tells you that you will have level repulsion. With an anti-Hermitian potential, you can imagine, perturbation theory gives you that you have a level attraction, basically. Because all you're doing is multiplying everything by I, and second order correction would give you an opposite sign, basically. Okay? And so, when you are just considering the dynamics which is related to sort of, you know, PT breaking, only two levels contribute, basically, for the most part. And therefore, this 2x2 model, although it looks very simple, is yet quite effective to describe a wide variety of phenomena. Okay. So you start out with, this is the model that I talked about, which is J sigma x and I gamma plus delta sigma z. I'm going to show this model by this picture. I have two sites, if you wish, or 2 degrees of freedom. They are coupled by a tunneling J. So it could be a rabbi drive, or it could be, you know, evanescent coupling between waveguides, or it could be mutual inductance if I have an RLC circuit with a minus RLC circuit, whatever have you. Okay. It has some positive I gamma potential here, which means the blue one is a gain site because it has a positive imaginary potential. It has an amplifying mode on that site. The negative I gamma, this is the red one, is the loss site. And in general, these two sites may not be at the same sort of, you know, Hermitian potential either. There will be some detuning, which is what I will call delta and minus delta. Okay. So this is one prototypical, it's called a PT dimer. There are other models which are of this type. Now, H2, which is minus J sigma Y plus I gamma sigma Z. That is a model in which basically what you have here is actually, it should be J sigma X and I gamma sigma Y, but it doesn't matter. This is a model which has a property that the H2 is purely imaginary, actually. And we'll see, actually, that is a kind of effective generator of motion that arises in a single LC circuit, you know, completely classical model. You can get that kind of generator of motion, basically. Common properties are shared by them. If I start with this Hamiltonian, these are the eigenvalues for it, as you can imagine. And the key part here is that sort of, you know, so what I've shown here are the real part of the eigenvalues as a function of gamma, the non-hermeticity, and the detuning, okay? And as you can imagine, these ones are, you know, basically square root functions, and they are complex, which means basically you are getting some Riemann sheet structure for your energies, basically, okay? So the energies look like Riemann sheets, which is what is shown here. This is the real part of the energy. This is the imaginary part of the energy as a function of non-hermeticity and the detuning. Okay? And a general result. Now, the key part is in this picture, the degrees of freedom, they could be any of these things that I have listed down here. They could be waveguides, which was one of the first experiments. They could be polarizations of a photon, which is one of the other things we have worked on, basically. For example, you can have a vertical, horizontally polarized photons. You introduce gain in one of them, loss in the other. You can go between them by having, you know, switching between one or the other by sort of going through a polarizer and things like that. There could be harmonic modes. So you know, this could be bosonic modes, you know, some A and B modes, for example. Okay? These could be quantum levels, as I'll show. In other words, not multiply occupied modes, but rather genuinely quantum levels of some single qubit or some single quantum object. Okay? This could be electrical circuits, which is far removed from the earlier example. This one is just macroscopic thing that you can look. Okay? This could be boson types. So this could be, you know, one of them is a polariton, the other one is an exciton. Doesn't matter. As long as there is a back and forth between them, and you can introduce loss in one, or you can, you know, amplify, somehow have amplification and losses, this description will work, basically. Right? Now, what are the properties of this kind of a Hamiltonian? The key properties are that because of this square root behavior, the exceptional point corresponds to a branch cut in the Riemann sheaves. So what is shown here, if I look at this red lines here that are coming together and going this way, that is the behavior of this when delta is 0. Okay? It's just j squared minus gamma squared, or square root of 1 minus z squared, if you wish, if z were the dimensionless constant, you know, gamma over j. Okay? And so you start out with two real energy levels. As you increase non-hermeticity, these two red lines come together. They meet at this point, and this is a point at which the eigenvalues become degenerate. But because it's a non-Hermitian matrix, the eigenvectors also become degenerate, actually. So at this point, the matrix has rank 1 instead of rank 2. Yeah. The same thing with imaginary part. The imaginary part, which is shown in these blue lines, initially it's 0. And then you get two modes, one of them with a positive imaginary part, the other one with negative imaginary part. They're just saying now you have an amplifying and a lossy mode. Yeah. And this part is of great interest in the classical physics or classical realizations of the system. This has been of great interest because of the enhanced sensitivity that you see at this exceptional point. You can see over here, there's this sort of square root feature. You know, you see that in, for example, a theory of magnetic magnetization as you go through, you know, magnetic to paramagnetic phase or any of these kind of common models, basically. And the key part here is really enhanced sensitivity, because if I am sitting at this degeneracy, if I am sort of, you know, Hermitian degeneracies give you linear response to perturbations. Here, because this is a square root kind of dispersion, you are going to get an enhanced response to perturbation. If I have a perturbation epsilon, you'll get a response which is epsilon to the power 1/2, basically a square root feature, which in practical terms is of very much interest to, you know, experimentalists and sort of engineers, because that means 1% perturbation is now giving you 10% response. If it's a linear response, 1% perturbation, 1% response. That's not, I mean, you could try to increase the, you know, the sort of cooperativity factor that's in the front, which is, you know, what's the multiplying factor, but not the qualitative behavior. Here it is qualitatively different, basically. There are other interesting things you can do with this kind of model. Because the energies are Riemann sheets, you can imagine doing topological switches from one sheet to the other. So let's say these are my two parameters. I can wander in this parameter plane. So if I start with this sheet and sort of go around this exceptional point, I will come back on the other sheet, even if I do this sort of slowly. Right? So this is your parking garage feature. Because, you know, in a parking garage, if you have gone through, you sort of take one loop and you end up on a different floor, basically, right? That's the common feature. And in this case, what that means is that you can change from one eigenstate to the other eigenstate by carrying out a cyclic evolution of your Hamiltonian, something you can never do in Hermitian Hamiltonians. Hermitian Hamiltonian cyclic evolution will at most give you non-abelian phase, right? Or some version, if you are doing it fast enough, you know, there could be some effects which are non-adiabatic one, but you will not get this. Okay. So this is something you can do. Now, I am talking about Hamiltonian models here, but you can do similar things with, you know, discrete time quantum walk models as well. So in other words, instead of defining Hamiltonian to be non-Hermitian, you could define a quantum walk to be non-unitary, where it has a unitary part and it has some, you know, loss gainy part and things like that, and you can once again carry out most of this analysis. That discrete time quantum walk becomes most relevant if you are doing modeling with photons, basically, where you have beam splitters and phase shifters, and so really you're implementing unitary or non-unitary gates on the qubit, right, as opposed to sort of, you know, doing some time evolution, basically.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all I have told you is kind of, it's high school student stuff, because it's 2x2 matrices. The real part is really just that real life means that there are lots of other things that you need to take into account. And the non-trivialities that you need to take into account beyond linearity is that there will be gain saturation, there will be thermal and quantum noise, there will be interaction effects, there will be many body effects, and a bunch of other things, basically, depending on what platform that you are focusing on. So here's an example of how you realize this Hamiltonian. This is work with Kater Murchis group. And so what you have is a superconducting circuit, basically, in a cavity, or at it's called superconducting transmon. This Q trait has three levels: ground state, first excited, and second excited. Okay. So it's an atom with three levels. The important part with this atom, as opposed to naturally occurring atoms, is that in this atom, you can tune the spontaneous emission decay rates. That's why you have these things to be made, sort of superconducting circuits, you know. So in particular, you can tune, sort of bath engineer, if you wish, the coupling of this system to the cavity, such that the spontaneous emission from the E state to the G state, this what I call gamma, is much faster than the spontaneous emission from F to E state, okay? In an experiment, this one is about 10 times as fast as that one, basically, right? And so if I start with this three-level system, of course, this three-level system is well-known. It's a dissipative Q-trait. It is described by Lindblad, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff is well understood, of course. And what would happen in general is no matter what state you start out in, eventually you will decay and come to ground state, basically. And so the long-term dynamics in this case is boring in that sense. But what's interesting is the following. If I start out with this system, let's say with some decay here, and this is the Rabi drive, which sort of connects between F and E levels. And if I measure this atom, keep measuring it, then what I will do is every time single shot measurements mean it tells me whether the atom is in the ground state or first excited or second excited. That's the data that I get. And as time goes on, the number of trials when I get it to be in the ground state increases because the atom decays, basically. Yeah. But if I only keep the trials where the atom, this is a lossy atom, but it has not decayed. So if I only keep the trials where the atom is found in the E and the F states, basically, okay, then keeping those trials, only looking at a lossy atom before it has decayed, gives you a dynamics which is described by this non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. So if I consider specifically the density matrix evolution in this manifold, F and E manifold, of this system, then that density matrix evolution is described by exactly that 2x2 model that I mentioned, with the J given by this and the gamma given by that. Okay. And so experimentally, that means you can realize this qubit by not looking at the entire three-level density matrix, but only the two-level density matrix that is post-selected, and therefore has trace one within the subspace as well. It has a description in terms of this non-Hermitian Hamiltonian plus non-linearities, but once you have this idea that this is how you make it, then you can really go to town, because these systems are known for their flexibility, their tunability, you know. So I can introduce J, I can introduce detuning between these two levels, which is what is called delta. In these experiments, gamma is not as easily tunable. So people fix gamma, the sort of the non-Hermitian term. And J and delta, which is the Rabi drive and the detuning, they can be sort of, you know, changed on fly, basically. So once you have that, then you can kind of go and start doing things. For example, if I have real eigenvalues, then I get oscillatory behavior, as you can imagine. This one is occupation of one of the levels. as a function of the time and as a function of the coupling rate J. And what you see is when J is large, then you get some Rabi oscillations, basically, that you expect. But once J goes small, above certain value, these oscillations have ceased because now you do not have real eigenvalues for the corresponding Hamiltonian. Remember, the eigenvalues are J squared minus gamma squared. So when you're sweeping J at small J's, you are in the PT broken phase or complex eigenvalues. When you have large J, you are in the PT symmetric phase. Okay. So you can measure that. You can extract out what are the frequencies along with this square root behavior. You can do the tomography of the qubit regarding how it is evolving. And one of the coolest things, in my view, was you can actually measure the inner product between the two eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. You can extract that because you can sample the qubit space and figure out what are the stationary states for a given Hamiltonian, basically. Okay? What are the two eigenstates? Okay? And what is plotted here is the inner product between the two eigenstates of this non-Hermitian Hamiltonian measured as a function of J, which is the coupling strength, for a fixed gamma. As I mentioned, if you are in the Hermitian limit, which is gamma, which is J very large, remember this is a log scale. So when J is very large, then you are roughly Hermitian. And so the inner product is close to zero. As you can see, it's sort of, you know, 0.1, 0.2 somewhere here. If you are in the other limit, when J is very, very small, then you are actually anti-Hermitian, which means once again, the eigenvectors are orthogonal to each other. Because your Hamiltonian is I gamma times some sigma z. Okay. Right? So once again, inner product is zero. But then in between, where you go across the transition, the inner product rises all the way to 1. So this is the first demonstration of actually measuring this non-orthogonality of eigenvectors in a truly quantum system to show that indeed you have an exceptional point as defined by coalescence of eigenstates, not just sort of, you know, degeneracies. And I mean, you know, this one is an example. Once you have this idea, you can do a lot of things, basically, which is what we have been working on with Keter Murchis group. For example, here is another example where you are wandering the Riemann sheets. I told you the complex energies look like Riemann sheets, right, basically. And if I'm wandering them, then I can have a mode switch because I can go from one sheet, one eigen sheet, to the other one, basically. Yeah. That means that in real life, I could start with some quantum state, slowly vary the parameters of the system, so that you are undergoing a cyclic evolution for the Hamiltonian, basically. And yet, you end up changing from one state to the other. This is the experimental sort of demonstration of it, where these are the Riemann sheets, these are the exceptional points, and you are taking some path in the J and the delta plane. So you're sort of, you know, going from yellow sheet and either going over to the blue sheet or crossing through here or not, basically, whether you go through the exceptional, I mean, go past the branch point or not. What is measured here experimentally are the components of the density matrix block or block components x, y, z as a function of time. And the key part that I want to sort of point out is over here, you started out with, you know, a minus x state, which is why x equals minus 1 here. And when you carried out this entire loop, you ended up in a state which is plus x, or very close to plus x. All you have done is you have gone through the parameter space once, come back to the same point in the Hamiltonian is restored back. And yet, doing this slowly, you have been able to change from state minus x to state plus x, basically. And this is really only possible because now the energies are complex and yet the dynamics is coherent, basically. So this coherent non-unitary dynamics gives rise to this topological quantum state control. If you want details, they are in this paper from last year, basically. Okay. But this is one of the set of things you can do. Now, if this period is not very long, if it's not very long, then there are Floquet considerations that come up, and you can sort of do that analysis as well, basically. But those are the kind of features that you get. And I should point out, this one is a dynamics which is taking up on megahertz time scale or megahertz frequency scale. Basically. So when I'm showing times here, if you have sort of seen, they're all in microseconds, basically. Okay. Well, if you did the static model, then the next step is to do Floquet model, basically time periodic behavior. So, you know, this is something that we learn in quantum mechanics, right? You first study static Hamiltonians, and then you come to Rabi problem. which is an atom coupled to a field, oscillating field. And the key part there is really that if the oscillating field had just the right frequency, then no matter what's the amplitude of the oscillating field, you will get a perfect population state transfer, basically. You'll get a complete inversion. Even if the applied electric field is very, very weak, you will still be able to do a full transfer because of the resonance condition. Okay? And you can do similar analysis now with non-Hermitian models, basically. So in other words, I have a Hamiltonian, which is these two, go through the calculations and get some kind of results, basically, regarding. And the key part here is, once again, that you get a rich landscape of complex energies and exceptional points, something that you, and therefore enhance sensitivities and things like that. Okay. You can go through that. You can implement it in an experiment with, this one is a work with Le Lua's group, for example, where you have a lithium atoms in a magneto-optic trap, basically. Once again, implement a rabbi drive between the two hyperfine states and implement some loss, which is by spin selective ejection from the trap into the continuum states, basically. So there is some sort of, you know, stuff needed to get down to this Hamiltonian, but we can do that. And then once you do that, in this case, though, the J and the gamma are both tunable on the fly, basically. On one hand, this is a kind of a semi-classical system because there are many, many atoms which are all non-interacting because you have sort of tuned the interaction between them through Feshbach resonance to, you know, the point where they are non-interacting, basically. But on the other hand, it's like a system like this, and then you can carry out the analysis and really see the effects of this non-Hermitian Floquet engineering, which allows you to create all kinds of evolutions which are not possible in Hermitian or dissipative models, basically. Okay. So these are sort of results here, though here the dynamics happens on a kilohertz time scale, basically. Okay. And one of the key features that happens in all of these sort of Floquet models is that you go from having sort of, you know, instead of requiring a non-hermiticity, which is large energy scale, you can get PT transitions at non-hermiticity, which is very, very small. Basically, arbitrarily small if the period of the non-hermiticity is appropriately tuned, if you are on the resonance, basically. So in that sense, it's really a non-Hermitian version of a rabbi problem. Okay? You can do this with semi-classical models, basically, or electrical circuits, where things are now on Hertz scale, if you wish. Okay? And so what I want to sort of, you know, go from here is that it's a good playground for a variety of things, basically. No. The models look simple, although each of them, if you want to really go through and do sort of, you know, connect with experiments, requires different levels of sophisticated calculations and things like that. But the idea is very simple, and it can show up everywhere, basically. So I think what I want to do, I think I have maybe 2 minutes, is to finish with an outlook. And then I'm happy to talk to people if they want to talk about this, because I'm very much interested in sort of developing these ideas across the board. So I hope I have given you the idea that coupled time reversal systems are interesting. Take a dissipative system, create its rough time reversed analog, and couple them. And you will find physics that you don't find in either of them or in unitary systems where there is no gain or no loss, basically. That's really the bottom line message. You can get realizations across classical and quantum domains. And because at least on some level, these problems are easily and numerically solvable, they are also highly accessible to a lot of young students, basically, you know, high school students, undergrads, and so on. So I want to end with showing you a remarkable example of ongoing work where this kind of coherent non-unitary dynamics gives you results which are not found in normal cases. Specifically, I'm talking about what is called Leggett-Gerg inequality, which talks about temporal correlations of a single qubit. So we are familiar with CH, SH as sort of, you know, our Bell inequalities, which are associated with spatial correlations of two qubits, which are, you know, removed from each other by doing some measurements, basically. This one was developed as a temporal analog of it in mid-80s or something like that, where I have a single qubit, And I measure it at time zero, or you know, time one, time two, and time three, basically, and cook up some combination of whatever are the correlations that will come up. There are definitions of these which I won't go into, but this Legendre parameter, K3, is bounded by minus 3 to 3 because each of these C's is bounded by 1, basically. And what you can show is that classical systems always have this smaller than 1, okay? It's also known that quantum systems, I'm only talking about single qubit and, you know, three-time measurements, quantum systems can go only up to 1.5. There are no dynamics, Lindblad, non-Markovian, you know, unitary quantum, any quantum sort of well-known models, basically, which will give you K3 between 1 and 1.5. And so 1 is considered classical, 1.5 is considered quantum. If you evolve this qubit according to non-Hermitian Hamiltonian, then you can get K3s which are above 1.5. You can actually go all the way up to 1, all the way up to 3, which is the maximum limit. What's shown here is an experimental data from David Alcock's group on a single trapped ion undergoing non-Hermitian dynamics, where they have measured the value of K3 as a function of time and as a function of non-hermeticity on this axis. They all start out at 1, which is sort of the classical limit, basically, at time t equals 0. And this time basically refers to what's the interval between 1 and 2 or 2 and 3. These are all equidistant intervals. So if I have time equals 0, then this is 1, this is 1, this is minus 1, which is why K3 always starts at 1. But you can see all the points which are above this plane are things that are super quantum correlations. These are correlations which you will not find in any dynamics, Lindblad or unitary, basically, but you find with this non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. So I think with that, I'm going to stop. And you know, thank you for your attention.
Feel free to ask questions. And also the online audience, feel free to unmute yourself to ask questions. Just got a basic question. So if we consider some PT symmetric Hamiltonian, if I turn some parameter to accord this exceptional point, so the energy can impair, right? Imagine energy can impair. Should I understand that as a spontaneous symmetric breaking or this PT symmetric system? Or?
Yes, you can think about it that way, because if your energy eigenvalues are real, then the eigenstates of your Hamiltonian can always be chosen as eigenstates of the antilinear PT operator as well, basically, you know.
Right.
So on the other hand, because PT is antilinear, once the energy becomes complex, if you go through the sort of derivation, what you'll find is that psi, if psi has eigenvalue, you know, some energy E, then PT times psi will have energy E star. So that's where you broke the... So psi and PT psi are not proportional to each other then. And that is the spontaneous symmetry breaking, which you would call, you know, PT symmetry breaking, basically, because now the eigenstates are not eigenstates of the PT operator. Right? Yeah.
I see. So then it is kind of, the mechanism is kind of different from a conventional symmetry breaking order, which requires some antibody, no interaction, thermodynamic limit, but this only requires a single qubit that you can.
Correct. That's right. Because of the antilinearity of the of this, you know, symmetry, if you wish. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So have you ever also talked about the interplay between many body system and with some PT symmetry flavor, like what kind of physics can emerge?
Let's talk. So okay. So let me be specific. Okay. There are many models of many body systems which are considered solvable, right? Usually that is because they are either some kind of projection operator sums, as you know, the Hamiltonian is somehow written as sum of some projection operators, like AKLT or some one of these things, or some exact techniques like bosonization or whatever are available, basically. You can always make models which, with complex parameters, the prefactors making complex, and you'll probably get something, basically. There are some models which have been studied that way. But usually the challenge with them is that none of them will be experimentally implementable.
Because it's a many-body system?
Because of typically, you know, the non-hermeticities that can arise by eliminating the quantum jump term are very constrained because the dissipators are not independent of the representation. So for example, you know, you have the sort of, you have Lindblad equation, right? And you will get a non-hermeticity in this case, which would be basically some kind of sigma z non-hermeticity. Mm-hmm. So if I ask, can I get sigma y? That requires, from what I understand, talking to experimentalists, that requires kind of bath engineering, which is so challenging that you cannot really do it, mm-hmm. basically, okay? And because of this Lindblad equation is basis, I mean, basically the point is, you know, you'll say, oh, well, sigma z, sigma y doesn't really matter. It's just rotation. Well, that's true for an isolated quantum system. But if you wanted to change to this basis, you know, new basis where it gives you sigma y, let's say sigma z to sigma y, it's going to, not only you're rotating your system, you're rotating your environment and all this stuff. So because of that, really, there are only few types of non-hermeticities that can be actually easily realized. And making models with that is not something that has been done a lot. There are works, of course. There are works regarding, in the classical domain, there are more works. So for example, you know, studying what happens to Costello-Stiles transition with some kind of non-hermeticity, basically, has been studied a while ago. But sort of, you know, taking some good models and then putting in non-hermeticity, which is doable, that's a part which is not really explored. No. So I'm happy to talk to people if so, because that's one of the, I mean, these are areas of my interest, is sort of, you know, how to look at models which we understand. Really, non-hermeticity in some sense provides an orthogonal direction to whatever area of research that people sort of have typically, you know. And so irrespective of that area, you can probably do something interesting if you move off in that direction, which is, you know, perpendicular to the your usual playing field, basically.
Right.
You know.
So is it of interest to ask, you know, what happens with many qubits, coupled qubits?
Yes, it is of interest, and that's something that we have worked on or work on. For example, we have looked at Ising model, transverse field Ising model, which would be a canonical example of a quantum phase transition, and, you know, try to put in non-hermeticities which are realizable to see what you get. We are able to find models where you will get an exceptional point. In other words, energies don't become complex right away. There are some non-hermeticities which will right away give you complex energies. In that case, it's not so interesting because it's trivially broken PTs, you know, trivially broken symmetry, basically. Now, beyond that, what happens, that's an open area. I mean, so for example, one of the other things we are looking at is like, you know, what happens to OTOFs? If I have some chaotic transverse field Ising model, so Ising model, transverse field Ising model plus an extra field, which is an orthogonal direction, which gives you, so it's not analytically solvable. And there are some results for how information propagates in it, which is what is OTOF, or, you know. Then the what happens to this now when I put in some non-hermeticities, which are of the type that we know gives you a finite threshold, don't know. There's just so much you can do with, like, you know, a single particle that interaction stuff is just coming in, basically, so to speak. You could also ask questions like whether there are models where you are getting sort of many-body non-hermeticity. But, you know, I mean, it's easy to think of questions which are difficult to answer. First think about questions which are easy, not easy to answer, but at least doable, sort of, you know, and experimentally doable. Yes. So that's sort of the goal, yeah.
In the context of a many-body problem, if you choose the non-Hermitian Hamiltonian to still be PT symmetric, you still get a real partition function, and so you'll still get a nice notion of thermodynamics. So that's maybe a motivation for choosing PT symmetry as opposed to a more general non-Hermitian operator in that context.
So the key thing here is the interesting thing here is this transition, right? exceptional point.
Correct. That's right. That you have, because you know you can always add some either a constant non-Hermitian piece, constant meaning proportional to identity, which will add some imaginary part to everything, positive or negative. But that's not going to have interesting stuff, because all you did was to take your energies and move them into a complex plane without sort of, you know, distorting them so that they can form intersections, which are Riemann shapes, basically. So, yeah.
And right at the transition, should we expect anything universal, like a, you know, the conventional critical transition, say in isomer there are some, you know, universal critical exponents in different observables, for example?
Right. So exactly. Again, short answer is don't know. There are, you can of course interpret this single particle simple models also in terms of some exponents and stuff. For example, how much does the energy gap and therefore period change? You know, and then depending on the order of the exceptional point, you will get like a square root or cube root or, I mean, not square, yeah, square root, cube root or whatever, power and things like that. But beyond that, because there are no models of genuine phase transitions the way they are understood in condensed matter with non-hermeticities, we do not really have answers to these questions regarding, okay, what happens to, for example, take some well-known model and then look at what happens to critical exponents at the phase transition point because of non-hermeticity, basically. No. Yeah. Any other questions?
We don't have any question from Zoom, so.
Okay. All right. So I'll wrap up.
Let's thank the speaker.
All right, thank you for the chance.